There's no denying the Catholic Church underwent radical changes following the Second Vatican Council. In the ensuing years, mass attendance, vocations, and the number of religious dropped precipitously. Justly or unjustly, Vatican II was blamed. So what went wrong with Vatican II? Noted author and theologian Ralph McInerney has attempted to answer that question in a new book and this three-part miniseries. In his first installment, Dr. McInerney explores what Vatican II was, what it was designed to do, and the much-discussed spirit of Vatican II.
Well, when one considers what it was like in the 50s, mass attendance and so forth, it's possible to look back on those times as an almost golden period. And I think it's important to become aware of those statistics and of the vitality of Catholicism in this country prior to the Council, because unfortunately a lot of people, in order to underscore the undeniable importance of the Council, think they have to sort of put down the pre-conciliar period. And when they do that, they malign a lot of very good people, very important people, as well as ordinary Catholics, and huge built up the church in this country. Mass attendance subsequent to the Council has gone into a nosedive. I don't know the exact statistic. People like Monsignor Kelly have those right at their fingertips. But they're not heartening. And people have to either be dismayed by them and think we have to do something to address this problem, or they have to interpret the bad news as somehow good news and assume that everyone there now is worshiping with an intensity hitherto unknown to Catholics, and that makes up for the want of numbers. I'm rather skeptical about that second interpretation. I think we have to get back to the sense of worship, of very dignified and solemn worship that will bring people back to church, not as an aesthetic experience, but with the sense that they're doing something appreciably different from what they do the rest of the week.
Dr. McInerney, what is the cause, do you think? Is there a root cause for the nosedive, as you just said?
Well, if you look for causes for things going bad, original sin is always a pretty good explanation. And sometimes it's impossible to get more fine-grained than that. But there does seem to be, the old adage is some people can't stand prosperity. And when things are going well, people don't think they're going well. I mean, I was there in the pre-conciliar period, and I thought at the time, and in retrospect, I think even more so, that it was a time of great vitality in the church. But so many of the things that were going on were kind of corrective movements. They thought that things weren't quite what they ought to be, and this should be done, and that should be done, and the other thing. So that vitality went hand in hand with the sense that, you know, things aren't quite going well enough. So that was a sense, I think, that if you ever let up, or you became complacent, or worse, if you began to think that what was going not so well was really going well, then the thing would start to unravel. And it's possible to think that one of the results of the Council was a kind of complacency about the status quo, that somehow there weren't mountains to be scaled and things to be done so much as here we are, in a kind of celebration of people as they were, and getting rid of guilt complexes and things like this, as if they were some temporary characterization of Catholics. Sure. And now I'm okay, you're okay, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Once that started, I think the declension was predictable.
In the book, you mentioned Fatima and Jacinta's mm-hmm. vision. How does that shine light on the situation we see before us now, and can you explain what that vision was?
I think you can't think of the Council without thinking of the Blessed Virgin, because in calling the Council, John the 23rd invoked in a very special way the patronage of Our Lady. In the Council itself, in the dogmatic constitution on the Church, the culminating chapter is on Mary as Mother of the Church. The present Holy Father, like his predecessor, sees his main task as the implementation of Vatican II, and we know of his Marian devotion. He was an attempt on his life was made on the anniversary of one of the apparition dates of Fatima, and when he recovered, he made a pilgrimage of thanksgiving to Portugal, to Fatima. It's possible, of course, to think of the Council without thinking of Fatima, but once you start thinking of them together, there is a kind of match, which I think is very interesting. In this specific way, Jacinta, one of the seers at Fatima, had, independently of the apparitions that they all shared, a vision of the Holy Father in a room praying, and outside crowds were yelling and shouting and throwing stones at the building and so forth. And this kid didn't know what that meant or anything, but she told Lucy, the one still surviving, and this etched itself in her mind, and later on when she was asked to write down everything, this is one of the things she mentioned. Now, it is possible, I think, to look on that as a kind of foreshadowing of some post-conciliar attitudes towards the Holy Father, not just the attempt on his life, but within the Church, kinds of attitude towards the Holy Father, which are extraordinary to me, which seem completely out of place and which perhaps are symptomatic of something else. But in that sense, I think, one, the Marian devotion of the present Pope, the role that the Blessed Virgin played in the calling of the Council, and the recognition of her role as Mother of the Church, and then with this Pope implementing it, his pilgrimage to Fatima. I don't think it's too far-fetched to see connections.
When we speak of Vatican II, the Vatican II Council, the Vatican II documents, what are we talking about? Can you briefly explain what is Vatican II?
What is Vatican II? Well, it's an ecumenical council. It was called the Second Vatican Council. The first one was in the 19th century, 100 years before. The Second Vatican Council was called by Pope John the 23rd in, I think, 1961. And he called it with a great deal of optimism. He just thought things were at a point where we could kind of put things together. He was a very holy man and a very serious man, not at all the sort of caricature that he's often shown to be. But optimism he did have, and he had just a tremendous hope for the Council. He said in calling it that he had a lot of gloom and doom people around him who told him things were really terrible. He said, "I don't believe it for a minute. I think this is a time of an upward rising Church, and we ought to celebrate this and go into modern times with a renewed sense of our mission and so forth." So he called the Council. It met for four sessions from 1962 to 1965. Pope John died after the first session. Paul VI was elected. He decided to continue with the Council. And it was during the next sessions that the documents that emerged as the product, so to say, of the Council were discussed, voted upon, and then promulgated by the Holy Father.
Now, when John the 23rd convened this great Council, his emphasis, was it pastoral or doctrinal?
The emphasis of the Council was supposed to be pastoral. I mean, John the 23rd said and thought that as far as clarity of doctrine, we don't need any more than we have. Everything is perfectly clear, so to speak, as to what we believe, why we believe it, and so forth. What he wanted was a pastoral council, meaning he wanted an aggiornamento, as he put it, an updating or modernizing of our means of evangelizing the world. And this is what he assumed the emphasis would be on. Almost immediately after it started, doctrinal questions came to the fore, as I think was perhaps predictable. There were certain documents that had been prepared before the council, which they perhaps thought would just breeze through and then they could get on to this other pastoral stuff. Well, they didn't breeze through, and there was a great deal of discussion and disagreement of a high-level theological kind. I think it's silly to look upon these discussions in a partisan way. If you look at the actual records of the exchanges, and they're printed, one can consult them, It's edifying to see the level of theological discussion among the bishops. It wasn't a matter of being left or right or conservative or progressive. It's very difficult to see most of the exchanges in those terms at all, or anything remotely like them.
What of the charges and some of the histories of the council that claim this was really a battle between traditionalists, conservatives, against progressives or liberals?
From the very beginning, the journalistic accounts of the council, and then the earliest, almost contemporaneous histories of the council, there was a tendency to look upon it in terms of conservative and liberal, progressive and conservative, progressive and, I suppose, retrogressive. But there was some sense to that in terms of the surroundings of the council. The journalists who were there, who talked as journalists tend to do to one another, they began to build up a drama. This sense of drama was fed by the pagriti, the experts that the bishops would bring along to advise them as to the matters under consideration for the council, theologians by and large. And many of them had an agenda, there's no doubt about it. Many of them, I suppose you could say, thought the church ought to go in a very different direction from which it had, and if that's progress, they were progressive and so forth. And others thought, with John the 23rd, that things were pretty well the way they were, and didn't see any need for any big changes.
Now, a priest I recently interviewed who was at the council, his charge was that the bishops were not necessarily prepared. What is your opinion of that?
Well, what you have in St. Peter's Basilica for an ecumenical council is all the bishops of the world. And they come there with various backgrounds. Some of them are very learned men. Some of them are very practical men. Some of them are in very sophisticated, cultivated centers, and some are in the backwood. They're the church. They're very different. But there, their function comes down to discussing, say, a document on religious liberty. Now, religious liberty is not a single issue. I mean, religious liberty, I suppose, in Nairobi is a very different issue than it is in, say, Denver. So it's very difficult very often for them to know what the problem is if they're from a certain part of the world. Whereas we, coming out of a pluralistic democracy which formed out of the need to sort of get beyond religious differences and find ways that people of different religious beliefs or none could live together, that raises questions of a theological kind which had been more or less unresolved, and these had to be resolved. But unless you're in this sort of political situation, it's sort of an unreal question, I suppose. There's a further problem for many bishops. Latin is the language of the church, but it's not the language of every bishop. And even in Rome, they have special linguistic experts to do the documents and so forth to make sure they're elegantly constructed and the like. So if you're not from a certain kind of background, say Roman University or other pontifical universities where a species of Latin was the patois of the day, you'd be at a bit of a disadvantage. And I think there was some of that maybe on the part of our bishops, American bishops, very practical men by and large, and men who, again, were part of an episcopacy that had built this tremendous thing, the church in the United States. But nonetheless, probably were a little, out of it when it came to fine-tuned theological discussion. Some of them, not all of them.
We often hear about the Ottoviani intervention and the series of interventions he put forward. Can you explain to us briefly what that consisted of and how disagreements like this were handled, according to your research?
There's one of the early histories of the council, which is a very balanced one, a very good one, I think. The Rhine flows into the Tiber. Gives an episode where early in the kind of pre-conciliar meetings, Cardinal Ottaviani was speaking, and they had agreed beforehand that there would be a set time limit and so forth, and he went over it the way people do, and they pulled the plug on him. And according to this history, the people there applauded. Now, I don't know if that happened or not quite that way, but it's a sad thing to read about. Cardinal Ottaviani was a saintly man. There's just no two ways about it. And he had done a tremendous amount of work as prefect of the Congregation of the Faith prior to the council, preparing, consulting all the bishops in the world. It wasn't some kind of hidden operation. And he had reason to think that they were ready to get together and move on from the consultation process to the discussion and voting. And a lot of people wanted to throw out those documents. And this was one of those occasions when he was really astounded, I think, by what was going on. Now, some people tie that down to his conservatism and pettifoggery and so forth. But there are other ways of looking at it. And it seems to me that as we move away from the time of the council, we have to take a more objective and serene attitude as to these differences. And episodes like that are unlikely in the future to cause the reader to want to applaud, I think, but to sadden him that kind of reaction was expressed, if it was, to that event.
Now, some say Vatican II, the documents of Vatican II, are not valid because they contradict earlier councils.
No.
Your opinion?
No. People who want to choose between councils or choose between popes are in an impossible logical position. I mean, you can't appeal from this council to a previous council without invoking the authority of a council. You can't appeal from this Holy Father to a previous Holy Father without invoking the authority of the papacy. So you're caught in a sort of thing. Now, people have tried to come up with analyses of the conciliar documents, arguing that they're internally inconsistent and that they're in conflict with earlier teaching of the Church. I have a simple answer to this. Bunk. I mean, if I believed that, I would cease to be a Catholic. The council was governed by the inspiration, finally, of the Holy Spirit. And you accept the council as not just the results of a meeting of a few fellows in Rome during a couple of years, but as that plus the guidance of the Holy Spirit. And to be a Catholic is to be confident that what the Church teaches is taught under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, and you don't choose the ones you might like and in favor of those you might like for whatever reason.
So what went wrong with Vatican II?
What went wrong with Vatican II? I mean, the fast answer would be that nothing went wrong with Vatican II. It's the wake of Vatican II. It's what's happened since that has caused problems in the Church. And I think a problem that was not really officially recognized for almost 20 years after the close of the Council. The Council closed in 1965. In 1985, there was a document, the Ratzinger Report, which was an interview with Cardinal Ratzinger by Vittorio Missori, an Italian journalist. And in it, Cardinal Ratzinger was very frank about the condition of the Church at that time. And he said things that, well, people hadn't acknowledged, people of his stature. That same year, in 1985, there was a second extraordinary synod called to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the close of the Council. And in that synod, the fathers acknowledged that there was a false spirit of Vatican II, that there had been people who had, in effect, tried to hijack the Council, turn it to ends very different from those intended by the conciliar fathers, or indeed compatible with the documents, which finally have to be our measure or our point of reference for what the Council was, and suggested that things had to be done to ensure that the true spirit of Vatican II would be acknowledged. So what went wrong with Vatican II? What does the Church say went wrong with Vatican II? One doesn't want just an individual's opinion here, and I take it that the second extraordinary synod was an official announcement or acknowledgement that there was a false spirit of the Council that had been abroad for 20 years and had caused grievous damage, and I think it's still abroad. I think it's still abroad. So if something has gone wrong, it's that the Council has been, in some cases, turned from its intended purposes, and not entirely, of course. There is the true spirit of Vatican II as well. But any struggle in the church, I think, can be seen not too simplistically as those two spirits rubbing against one another.
Some theologians then and now have tried to make a distinction between official magisterial teaching mm-hmm. and papal teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference?
Well, you have, the thing is, you would go to the council, first of all, and you'd go to see what the council tells you about that. And if you did, you'd go to Lumen Gentium, the dogmatic council on the church, to paragraph 25. And this will tell you about the papal magisterium and the weight that we assign to the teachings of the Pope and so forth. Now, in more recent documents, there's actually been a sorting out. I mean, theologians have always known, and learned people have always known, that there's a different valence or weight that can be given to different teachings, even of the Pope. But conciliar teachings, of course, have a supremacy over the papal, because they have to be promulgated by the Pope. But they're way up there in terms of authoritative document. But what we have been reminded again in recent documents is this: those gradations of weight of authority and so forth do not permit any difference of response on the part of a faithful Catholic. You accept what the Church teaches, and that's all this stuff, not just the stuff at the top of the list and so forth. For practical purposes, those gradations are insignificant and unimportant for ordinary Catholics.
Do we have to obey only infallible teachings?
That's infallible teaching. Sometimes people will say, well, I will obey what's infallibly taught by the Church, and I don't have to obey the rest. I might say nice things about it, but I don't have to obey it. Well, of course, then you have to go to, well, what constitutes infallibility, and when is infallibility invoked, and so forth. And you'd go back to the documents that I mentioned a while before, conciliar, and then the recent apostolic letter in which this has been addressed. And again, there is no option for someone. Oftentimes by infallible, people mean something that has been formally an ex cathedra pronounced by the Pope. You could probably get a handful of such items. You wouldn't recite the whole creed, you know, if you held yourself to that. So obviously this is too austere a standard. How little need I believe? You know, what's the minimum here and so forth? And that's not the proper response. I mean, imagine somebody listening to the Sermon on the Mount and saying, now how much of this do I really have? No. I mean, that's not the response that you would expect from someone who is listening to a teacher unlike all others. You just figure, I'm going to pay attention here, and I'm not going to grade him, and I'm not going to grade his remarks in terms of seriousness or importance.
This almost game to find out how much I can disbelieve and yet still be a member of the Church has really been going on since the Council, and I suppose before. But now they appeal to the spirit of Vatican II. What is the spirit of Vatican II, and how has it led to some of these excesses?
Well, to appeal to the spirit against the letter of Vatican II would put me in mind again of that extraordinary synod in 1985. Which spirit do you have in mind, the good spirit or the evil spirit, the false or the true spirit of Vatican II? But the fact of the matter is, literal meanings are terribly important in any theory of the interpretation of Scripture or any other document. You have to know what the words mean. And when you're going to talk about Vatican II, it seems to me there is no way in which you can talk about it except in terms of the 16 documents that were voted on and promulgated by the Holy Father. That is Vatican II. Then we have a subsequent set of documents of implementation and so forth. But in a narrow and quite specific sense, Vatican II is those 16 documents. That's the letter of the thing. Now, you get the spirit of the letter. You don't bring the spirit in from someplace else and wonder whether the letter fits it or not. I've sometimes had people suggest to me when I say things like this, always carefully avoiding giving my own opinion as opposed to what the Church teaches, that to want to hold the meaning of Vatican II to the documents is fundamentalism. And of course, this is not meant as praise. Fundamentalism is a nasty thing to call somebody. But if fundamentalism means taking the text seriously here, I'll live with it.
What would your advice be to those who have heard and seen actions that individuals know are not befitting the church and really shouldn't be occurring, yet those who are perpetrating them claim we are acting in the spirit of Vatican II? Mm-hmm. What should be our reaction as loyal Catholics?
Well, what do we do when somebody says, I'm doing this and it outrages you, and they say, this is the spirit of Vatican II? Let's hope it's something that's not manifestly in conflict with the moral law. But if it's some kind of excess in liturgical celebration or something like that, I don't think there's a single answer to that. What one doesn't want to do is to go to Mass and be sitting there as like the critic for the New York Times who has to write a savage review before he goes to bed that night. That isn't why we're there. But sometimes things force themselves upon us in a way that it makes it almost incumbent from the point of view of conscience to say or do something about it. But that such things happen, we're not responsible for their happening. There are other people who have... I am speaking here as a layman. It's not my responsibility to make sure that the liturgy is properly conducted and all that sort of thing. There are other people whose responsibility that is. And maybe in some extreme cases, I would feel that it's part of my obligation as a layperson to let him know what's going on the assumption that if he knew, clearly he would not permit it to continue. Let's hope that would be true.
But the fault certainly does not lie with the documents of Vatican II. It is in the interpretation and implementation.
Absolutely, absolutely. Chesterton once said of Christianity that the problem is not that it's been tried and found wanting. It hasn't been tried. And I think this is true of the Council, too. We're still on the threshold of implementing Vatican II. The best is yet to be.
Be sure to join Ralph McInerney and I for the next installment of What Went Wrong with Vatican II. Next time, we'll examine the rise of dissent in the Catholic Church and the philosophy that led to a rampant misinterpretation of the Vatican II documents. Until next time, I'm Raymond Arroyo. See you soon.